You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as The Daily Meditation Podcast, I Know What Scares You, and When Things Go Wrong. If you'd like to advertise on the show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Friend of the show, Carl Mamer of the Conspiracy Skeptic podcast, pointed me to the inspiration for this week's episode, an article by archaeologist Andy White from 2016, responding to a paper produced by Bigfoot researcher Mitchell Townsend. Links to all this stuff will be in the show notes. The paper Townsend published, which is hosted at the interestingly named website SasquatchGenomeProject.org, is a nearly 100-page description of some bone-stacking behavior observed near Mount St. Helens, which the author attributes to Bigfoot. Andy White wrote his response in a thoughtful, rational way that reminded me very much of happier times in the world of online cryptozoology, when people would posit serious ideas and others would critique them. White's response is focused on the claims in Mitchell's paper, and while I think the temptation to dunk on the befuddling nature of the claims or the paper's author itself might be powerful, the archaeologist sticks to the arguments, and I found that commendable. I asked Andy to dust off his response and refresh his mind and to come and talk with us today about how and why he posted his rebuttal. I found it all to be very nostalgic for better times on the net, but the lessons are still valid, and I liked his approach. We don't have to fight with people about stuff we disagree on. We can let the ideas do combat. And in the end, I think the scientific approach hews closer to the underlying truth than wild speculation does. Have a listen to this interview and see what you think.
Monster Talk.
So, welcome to Monster Talk. Tonight we're talking with Andy White, who is an anthropological archaeologist. But since it's our first time talking, I'd like Andy to introduce himself. How would you like to be known, Andy?
I am a professional archaeologist. I've been doing this for, 30 years now. I've kind of spent some time engaging with pseudoscience and pseudoarchaeology maybe for the past decade. Most of what I deal with is stuff like lost civilizations, ancient giants, you know, stuff like that, that is kind of one of those things that I think are egregiously false and wrong stories about the human past. But as you know, I do stray into things like Bigfoot and that sort of thing.
And we all do. So,
we all do. You can't escape it.
I came to find your article through Carl Mamer, who is host of a podcast called The Conspiracy Skeptic. Definitely a friend of the show and a friend in real life. Although we are separated with him living in Canada, so we can't be close like we'd surely like to be. But Carl pointed me to your article about Bigfoot bone stacks, and I found it really interesting. And it reminded me of ye old good days, or ye good old days, the past when I used to roam around on the internet on cryptozoology forums and comment and read, and just, you know, everything wasn't trapped in the social media, you know, walled garden, and you could just really have some great conversations and ask really interesting questions. But let's get started with our interview questions, and I'll let Karen kick it off.
Yeah, I will. So, hi, Andy. Let's start at the top. What is your article a response to? And can you kind of summarize the claims that are made in the online posts and the academic paper that you're critiquing?
I can, but it took some doing. So I put in the hours for you. I had to go back.
Thank you.
Because the blog, you're welcome. The blog post was years ago at this point. It's not something that I think about a lot. So I went back and I reread that and I checked the links. The links are still active. So the paper is still up. So it was a 94-page paper, a research paper.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That this person, Mitchell Townsend, who is also known as Dr. Johnny Dagger.
Hey,
that's right. Stunned silence. Right. Yeah. No, when you follow these threads out, it always turns into this weird.
No complaints. I'm known as Dr. Atlantis. I'm not a doctor, nor am I from the mythical underwater city. So I get the vibe.
You know, I don't know much about him, and there's not much about him out there. So the first thing I like to do is look at the claim, right? You look at the claim, take it at face value, and try to figure it out. But the personalities are also interesting. Science and these kinds of things are human endeavors, so I'd like to know who's behind this stuff. But anyway, 94-page paper claiming that he first found a pile of bones, including a stack of ribs, somewhere on the side of Mount St. Helens or in the foothills of Mount St. Helens or something like that. And he could figure out no other explanation for those other than they were the remains of a Bigfoot's kill site and meal. And then some students got involved and apparently found two more. So they thought they had a pattern of behavior. They documented these things. They collected some of the bones, brought them back. They looked at tooth marks. They claim that they eliminated all other possible sources, you know, for these assemblages. And that's the basis of their paper. And he concluded,
the totality of the evidence analysis very conclusively proves that a new hominin species with an estimated height of over 8'8" and a 16-foot print and physically capable of striding over two times the distance of a contemporary human is currently living and feeding upon various ungulate species in the immediate vicinity of Mount St. Helens.
So that's what he thought that he had demonstrated with the evidence that he put forward. As an archaeologist, I like claims that come with material evidence of things that already happened. Like that's what we do. You know, we dig around in people's garbage and we try to make sense of human behavior based on the things that are left behind. So claims about Bigfoot walking through portals and, you know, coming in on flying saucers, I'm not interested in that. But like, okay, so here's a pile of bones, you know, that he's attributing this to Bigfoot behavior and saying there's no other explanation. So that to me is an interesting claim. So that's why I kind of got interested.
It is interesting. And now, it was one thing is when I looked in the paper itself, it is long and it's a little different from most of the academic papers that I've read. And I'm not going to try to critique the style, but it was different. It seemed more conversational than I'm used to. But you've done some analysis on the actual claims, and can you outline the key reasons why you think maybe Bigfoot's not the culprit behind these discoveries?
Maybe.
Yep.
Just maybe. There's a chance. You know, again, I don't know the guy. So I try, and when I would teach critical thinking to my students, I said the first thing you want to do is you boil down the claim to its essence. Like what are they actually saying? And what's the evidence to back up that claim? And when you start to do that, like you can kind of get beyond a lot of the let's see if I can restate that. If you take your time and boil the claim down to an essence, you can kind of set aside, at least temporarily, perhaps what the motives are or the aspects of belief that are in there, and you can.
Right. You work on the actual arguments, the testable claims, right?
Yeah. Right, right. So when I skim through the paper, I notice that he commits a couple of kind of key errors in thinking or logic or assumptions, I guess, that give me pause. One is that there's kind of this submerged thesis that everything he's looking at, in archaeology, we call it the Pompeii premise. You know, this idea that something happens and then time is kind of frozen and you get a record like a crime scene. And that's really not the way things work most of the time. So he interprets this as a kill site where Bigfoot did the killing, Bigfoot did the eating, and then Bigfoot did whatever else was there, and that's all the behaviors that you need to account for everything that's at the site. And so to me, that's a bit of a red flag, because we know there are all kinds of other natural taphonomic things that go on, and there's kind of a lot of assumptions built into that perspective. And the other thing that he does, especially with the, he has a lot of discussion in there of tooth marks on the bones, which he says are similar to human tooth marks, or they suggest a human dentitionally, I think it was like 2 or 3 times larger or something like that. He doesn't go through the steps of eliminating everything else that it could be. He kind of jumps to this conclusion that because Bigfoot did the killing and Bigfoot's doing the eating and they look like human molar marks, but they're too large. So I was completely unconvinced by that part of the paper. He didn't do the hard work, I think, of eliminating other alternatives. And yet we're expected to believe that those other alternatives have been effectively eliminated, because there's a lot of jargon in the paper. And I think that's there to dazzle you. You know, like you said, it's a strangely written, because he's got his like kind of firsthand account. I saw this and then I did that. But then when you get into it, you know, he has words in there that I don't even think are part of the English language that I did not understand. And I looked up and I could not figure out what he was talking about. I kind of put it together after a while, but it's bizarre.
It's different. Yeah.
Different is a very kind word. Yes.
So, Andy, you mentioned the absence of what you refer to as high utility parts in the bone stacks, and suggested some alternative explanations. Could you delve deeper into these alternative hypotheses and explain a little as to why they cast doubt on the idea that Bigfoot was involved here?
Yeah, so that's kind of what piqued my interest in the first place. There has been a longstanding debate, you know, over the course of decades in anthropological archaeology, especially related to human evolution, on understanding bone assemblages that are left behind by humans and what it can tell us about their behavior. And this all started because Lewis Binford in the 1970s and 1980s was pushing back on this idea that early humans were hunting a lot of large game. So he said, look, if you go and you live among the Inuit, for example, you'll see that when they kill a caribou, they take the parts that have a lot of utility. They take the shoulders and they take the thighs, and then they leave behind the parts that don't have a lot of caloric value for their weight. So that's like the spinal column, the foot bones, and the head. And he said, if you look at these early human assemblages, they are head and foot and spine dominated assemblages. In other words, these humans do not have access to the prime parts of the carcass, meaning they're getting there after the other scavengers have already gotten there. And they're getting things that the other scavengers can't make use of. And that's the stuff that they carry back and they smash with their hammer stones and so on and so forth. So that gives us the concept of these high utility versus low utility parts. So when I looked at these purported bone stacks, they have things like ribs, foot bones, and deer skulls. None of the good stuff is there. And that is a problem right away, because you have to explain where the good parts of that carcass are or where they went. So if you follow out the chain of logic, if they were there to begin with, if this was a kill at that site, then somehow the Bigfoot is butchering this thing or tearing it into pieces. The high utility parts are gone. And then he's sitting there and he's snacking on the very worst parts of the carcass. Like, I don't know if you're from the South, right? So you've eaten ribs.
I sure have.
They are the messiest, hardest thing to eat. There's no meat on those. Like you know, you have to really work. I hate ribs for that reason. Like they are, you know, it's not my cup of tea. So you have two explanations then. What happened to those high utility parts? One is they were never there to begin with. Mm-hmm. So maybe parts of the carcass were moved there for, you know, making like a bait for other predators, for hunting bears or coyotes or something like that. Like that's one possibility. And I don't know anything about that stuff, but like that's what the game guy said that he quoted, that, you know, that's what it looks like. It looks like a bait pile. And the other possibility is that the deer were killed there and then the high utility parts were taken away. So that could have been by a human, if a human did it, because that's what a human hunter would do. They would leave behind the head, the feet, and the spine, and they would take the shoulders and the thighs. Or Bigfoot took it away. And that's the more interesting possibility. So if Bigfoot is taking them away, where is Bigfoot going with those pieces of high utility carcass? And the answer would be back to like a home base, like an early human evolution model where you were provisioning your family, you're going out and hunting, you're taking things back. And you know what happens at those sites is you get really big accumulations of broken bones and other detritus, and you have an archaeological site that we can find 2 million years later. And if that's the case, why can't we find one that Bigfoot made last week where they've been living for, you know, months and months or years and years or hundreds of years? And that's the part that makes no sense to me. So something does not compute there at all. If that's a Bigfoot kill site, then where's the Bigfoot home base site?
Well, I would suggest one thing is that, you know, with humans, especially a long time ago, we had to use stone tools to do this work, which was very messy. But all this Bigfoot stuff can be done with the incredibly sharp Occam's razor, which doesn't leave a mess. The stacking behavior, though, like these bone assemblages, do we know of any animals that do that besides humans? Or, I mean, I don't want to dismiss that, because sometimes animals, especially, you know, pack rats, there's animals that do weird things with items. I can think of a few examples where they make things with other animals' trash.
And again, like, I don't know enough about, so like, he's right. If you look at the photos, at least one of those, like, there is a stack of rib bones there. Though I put stack in quotation marks.
Yeah.
I'm doing air quotes. I know you can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes. Because stack to me suggests, you know, like I'm sitting there with my dinner plate. I eat a rib, I put it down. I eat a rib, I put it down, you know, carefully next to that one. And I make a little stack on the side of my plate or whatever.
Yeah.
That's what stacking implies. It looks like a jumble of rib bones. So it's like an assemblage that's there that's not articulated anymore with the rest of the skeleton. So how does that happen? I don't know. If you're making a bait pile, do you have a bucket full of ribs and you dump them out? And that's where the rib pile comes from. Like, when my kids find a deer skeleton, they start picking up bones and putting them into a pile, you know? So I can think of a lot of different ways that might happen that don't involve some kind of supernatural, undetected 8-foot hominid walking around in the forest. So I feel like the word stacking, I think, kind of implies part of a behavior that I wouldn't necessarily assume is there. And if you look at some of the pictures, like one of the quote unquote bone stacks, there are ribs scattered around and one of the ribs is sticking out of a clump of grass. That is not a stack. I don't care what your definition of stack is. That does not yeah. cut it. Yep. So, you know, if you want to believe that, sure. Any assemblage of bones can be manipulated by Bigfoot. But if you're looking for a real pattern of behavior,
I will not hear you critiquing Bonehenge.
Oh, and the other weird thing is the first one that he found had two deer skulls at it. So either Bigfoot is like ambushing deer in groups.
Yeah.
And killing them somehow, or, you know, because it's not like a single hunter's kill, but sometimes when you see stuff that's left behind by poachers or whatever, like they'll take multiple deer and they'll butcher them all. And if you look at the small number of rib bones, one has four, the other one has four. Like, I looked, and the best I could do is count the ribs on a picture of an elk that I found today. So I don't know whether it's, you know, I'm not gonna defend it in court, but maybe 26 ribs. So what kind of behavior leaves behind just a couple? And my answer to that is probably the rest of them are all scattered around and eaten by bears or coyotes or whatever, and they just didn't happen to see them, or they were completely consumed by some of these other scavengers that he says don't exist. But I feel like you kind of have to weigh the negative evidence there a little bit too. So overall, I feel like it's a very unconvincing argument. And when you're making that argument, like, the burden of proof is on you, not me. Mm-hmm. But the anthropologist bell goes off in me, and like, that's why it just didn't make any sense.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
We've got a podcast recommendation I think will be really fun and or useful for Monster Talk listeners. I Know Dino, the big dinosaur podcast.
Studying dinosaurs can teach us about the prehistoric world, but also the world of today. For example, migration patterns of dinosaur lineages can tell us about the Earth's changing continents.
Climate models of dinosaur ecosystems help us understand global warming.
Studying dinosaur diets can help show the link between plant and animal evolution.
Talk about paleo. In many dinosaur injuries, paleopathologies are the first known occurrences of diseases.
A new episode of I Know Dino comes out every week with new dinosaur discoveries you won't hear about anywhere else. You can find I Know Dino on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This reminded me of so many online Bigfoot discussions that I've been a part of or have read. And one of the recurring claims that you will hear around why you never find Bigfoot bones is because in the Pacific Northwest, the soil is very acidic and no bones are left behind. Between the work of ground, you know, animals that like to chew on bones, I think between that and the acidity of the soil, you just never find bones. And now, I knew instinctively that that was not so, but this seems to be a pretty clear indication that whatever bone disappearing act is going on in that soil, and I'm not saying that the acidic soil doesn't break down bones, it's not instantaneous and there are bones available. So I think we can learn something from this, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's bones all over the place. And I get that argument. Another argument I've heard is that they're burying their dead somewhere.
Yes. Like, again, yeah.
We have, you know, I don't know how many tens or maybe even hundreds of skeletons of Neanderthals now who were burying their dead, you know, 40, 50, 60, 100,000 years ago. We find them. The fact that nobody has ever found a Bigfoot burial or, you know, I know this is a short podcast, but like my critique of the Bigfoot phenomenon, even as I'm kind of looking at it from 30,000 feet, because I don't get into this stuff too much, because none of it is really compelling to me, you know? So like, I'm interested in why people believe in it. And like, it really feels like a belief system rather than like, they don't want to find the truth. Yeah. They want to find things that confirm their beliefs. And that's tough when you get in there to apply critical thinking. Like, I get it. It's almost like a religion. You know,
Well, and also
we've discussed that.
We sure have. The number of, it's kind of like the number of, anthropologists who believe in Bigfoot is kind of like the number of astronomers who believe in UFOs in the sort of from another planet sense. It's not a zero number, but it's a real small number. That this kind of scientific training, if you take it seriously and take it to heart, tends to push you away from believing in these things being literally real creatures.
I always ask, like, what's the evidence? Like, is it possible that there's a large hominid wandering around? Sure. You know, and there were species of big primates that weren't, quote unquote, discovered, you know, by Europeans in Africa until relatively recently in the modern era. So, like, that's fine. We find new species all the time. But if you look at the totality of it and you say, like, what's the claim being made and what's the evidence for it? You know, the claims are really, really big and the evidence for it is so very thin. And all you would need is one.
Yeah, exactly.
Real bone, you know. One, just give me one of anything, and it's none. They all evaporate, and then you have to invoke conspiracy theories about people hiding evidence, or you have to invoke some kind of supernatural powers and things like that. And like, you get out of the realm of anything that science can actually deal with really quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Andy, your response discusses tooth marks that were supposedly found on the bones. Have you been able to follow up on this aspect of the arguments?
Well, I followed up on it today, as in I read the report again. I am not a tooth expert. I actually know, or I did at one time, I don't do it anymore, but I knew quite a bit about human teeth. But I don't know a lot about bear teeth or coyote teeth or wolverine teeth or anything else. And I feel like that's the error that is made in that section, is he looks at parts of the bones that are chewed or bitten off. And there are, like, he has nice pictures of them. Like, there are a lot of tooth marks on those things. Something has been chewing on them. And then he finds confirmatory evidence that these look like this kind of human incisor, or these look like, you know, this kind of juvenile human molar, without eliminating any of the alternatives. Like, how do I know that's not a bear canine or incisor that did that? Right. And he doesn't provide any of that evidence. So
he doesn't include, like, the measurements with the scale and what, you know, so you can see the curvature and that sort of stuff.
He does. He has pictures, and there are a lot of measurements in the text.
Ah.
But again, like, I as the reader shouldn't have to do the work to go, okay, let me make sure those aren't bear.
Yeah.
Like, that's something that in a real paper, you would eliminate that in the real paper, which is why this is published on the Sasquatch Genome Project and nowhere else, because it's not a real paper. It's a,
yeah,
you know, it is what it is. He put a lot of work into it, but ultimately, like, if this paper came to me for peer review, even me not knowing all these specifics, like, I would say, you need to do all this stuff and then resubmit. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not up to me to do that work.
Yeah.
But as a skeptic, I'm like, well, you're making a claim here that there's a, you know, an unknown hominid out here doing these things. Your claim is based on the tooth marks look like human tooth marks to you, only they're scaled up. You don't eliminate any other possible alternatives. That's not enough at all. Mm-hmm. That's nowhere near enough. So I feel like there's a lot of wishful thinking and wanting it to be true. And that's, as you, I think both of you would agree, I've now known you now for half an hour.
You've known us long enough.
That's kind of part of it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, the reason we had you on, or we asked you to come join us, and I appreciate it, is because what you did in your article was a very rational analysis of someone else's Bigfoot claims. And they sort of put on the cloak of science in their approach, but I don't think it fit them well in the sense that they were saying sciencey things, but it didn't feel like a proper methodological approach to this case, situation, whatever you want to call it, this phenomenon. And what you did in your writing is exactly what I would like our listeners to do, is when you see a strange claim, think about it. Like, does it make sense? You know, does this claim hold up? Is there adequate evidence for it? You know, get beyond this feels cool and mysterious. What an interesting question. We don't have to stop with that's an interesting question. We can actually get a little further even without having to travel to the Pacific Northwest. There are things you can deduce. If there's inductive reasoning, et cetera, that you can do if you have the proper training skills and just sort of think it through. And introducing a Bigfoot into the story is always a giant leap, because we don't have any proof that Bigfoot's a real animal. So you always have to eliminate every possible natural explanation and known explanation before you hop to Bigfoot or chupacabras or dogmen or whatever, you know? And so I thought this was really well done, and it gave me a good warm feeling of nostalgia for the good old days of my Bigfoot youth.
your misspent Bigfoot youth.
Yeah. Well, hey, now I will say, and I say this all the time, but I still believe it, many a sharp mind was honed on the whetstone of Bigfoot. Like, I think it can teach you critical thinking if you let it, you know. I mean, you can certainly learn how to, and I think one thing that happens to a lot of people is they start out as believers and then they start running into, oh, well, that's a good argument. Oh, I didn't think about that. And then they might become disillusioned. But if they don't become disillusioned and they don't become big bundles of cognitive dissonance, it can be a gateway to learning how to think critically about weird claims, which I think is an extraordinarily useful skill. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate you exercising it in your article.
We do.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Like, I don't know how old you are. You're probably younger than I am, but I grew up on In Search Of.
No, I'm 54. Yeah. I literally love In Search Of way more than I should. So, yeah.
We're the same age. So I'm.
Me too, but I'm a bit younger.
Yeah.
So, like, I grew up on that stuff. I wanted it to be true. You know, I wanted these fantastic things to be true. And then even through high school and college, like, and, you know, back in the pre-internet days, like, you'd have to go to the library and check out books on this garbage in order to digest it or get whatever you could on TV. And as I was, like, I read more and more of that stuff. And as I, you know, learned how to do archaeology and learned about the real prehistory of the world.
You don't realize
that that stuff is garbage. But
well, you learn the stuff that the producers chose not to include. That's the that's the missing sauce.
Right. Right. But it has served me well too. You know, like going like, well, I know that this is probably wrong, but like, how can I prove that it is wrong? Or do I need to prove, like, you start to understand claims and being able to dissect them and try to understand them and figure out where they're coming from and what science is about and how you do it and the inductive side, the deductive side. And like, all those are great. And I feel like they are sorely lacking in our society today, unfortunately. And well, I used to teach a class called Forbidden Archaeology for 3 years, where that was the main, we talked about all of this kind of garbage pseudoscience and pseudoarchaeology, you know, stuff that has to do with the human past, Atlantis and all that stuff. No offense, Atlantis is fake, but
what?
it's related to European colonialism and, you know, slavery and all that good kind of stuff. But it, you know, to teach people, like, you can assert anything you want. You can say anything you want, but how do you know when somebody does that, whether their story is credible or not? How do you discriminate between two alternative explanations? Like, what's the process that you go through to do that? And those are great, great thought exercises. You know, all of these kind of outlandish claims are fun to talk about, but in a way, to circle back around, like, I think they're actually teaching you something very important about the process of discerning what, not even what truth is, but kind of what you can hang your hat on and what your best, you know, better served leaving alone.
I think Bigfoot has a low anger content. There are some people who get very upset about Bigfoot, but and we also like to say that in the world of Bigfoot, you see the entire spectrum of human belief writ small, you know, because you find people who don't believe at all the way to people who treat it exactly like a religion. But in between there, you can engage with all kinds of levels of belief and ideas and learn how to engage and discuss stuff with people in ways that don't trigger big fights, but maybe actually can, you know, sway people to think a different, not necessarily to change position, but to at least think about it in a more critical way that helps them sort of eliminate the nonsense, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a spectrum, you know, from there's your con men, and most of them are men. Most of them are white men, probably. there's your mentally ill people. There are your, you know, people who are religious about it, who are true believers, and then there are the genuinely curious. And like, that's the audience that I try to reach, is the genuinely curious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I've had people write me emails and say, you know, I found your blog post. Like, you're a backstop for me for understanding this stuff. And so like, that was one of the things that got me interested in writing and like talking about this stuff publicly, because there need to be resources out there to think through some of these things and to help people do
that. Oh, absolutely.
Like,
it's
a public service.
Yes.
Well, since our search engines no longer work, at least we can point people to your content through our podcast posts, right? So that'll help. I have one quick sort of not directly related question, because a lot of our listeners are younger and are interested in science careers. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do professionally with your training and education? Like, are you working in field right now? And or just, you know, is there anything you'd like to say to people who are interested in becoming archaeologists?
Yeah, don't do it. Yeah.
Okay, that's what I've heard from most archaeologists. I'm not even joking. But
no, it's a fascinating profession. It's not at all what most of the public thinks it is. I love it. I find it very fulfilling. At this point, like, I'm working. I'm kind of in the pasture, not out in the field anymore. So I do a lot of report writing and analysis. I do a lot of computer simulation and modeling. But it requires a lot of education, I think, to kind of do it right. But I feel like the questions that we try to answer as archaeologists, like, humans are really, really hard to study, even in the present. Like, ask a psychologist or a sociologist how easy it is to figure out what humans do. And then try to do that in the past when you can't actually see them, when all you have are little bits of garbage left behind. And that's archaeology. So we are trying to answer questions on big scales of time and space with very little record. And it's tough. So in some ways it's very fulfilling, and in other ways, like, you know, I know some of the questions that I have about humans and why we are the way we are and why things are the way they are, like, will probably not be answered by the time that I die. And that's kind of depressing, but at the same time, like, I feel like it's kind of, you know, it's a noble pursuit in a way. You're not going to get rich doing it. It's not about finding a lot of artifacts and selling them. There's ethics involved and that sort of thing, but I feel like getting the human past right is important, which is one of the reasons why I chose to engage with pseudo-archaeology and pseudoscience, because a lot of the kind of misappropriation of the human past has a pretty sinister side to it. historically, and there's a lot of bad context. There is a lot of racism and white supremacy and things like that that go into ideas and claims about Atlantis and giants and all these kind of fantastical things, ancient aliens that people think are funny. There's a dark side to that. So it's important, I think, to help people understand the context. But, you know, it's not for everybody. I will say that. And sometimes, some days, I don't think it's for me, but most days I'm pretty happy with my choice still.
Well, thank you for doing it. So I appreciate
it. Yeah, absolutely. Andy, you're our kind of guy. But this is your first time on the show, so hopefully we can have you back on again about some other topic. But we always like to ask our guests when they come on for the first time a particular signature question. So I'm going to ask you now, what's your favorite monster?
So I was prepared for this question, and I thought about it all day, Karen. And
thank you.
I finally came up with my answer, and I'm going to waffle, and I'm going to divide my favorite monster into three different pieces, which each piece has a representative.
So it's a chimera. What?
Right. Yeah. Done. See you later. Thank you very much. Now, the first one is monsters from my childhood, and this is a general group award that I knew were not real. And that's like your monsters from Godzilla, like Mothra and stuff like that I would enjoy watching on Saturday morning. And those really, really bad movies from the 1950s and 1960s. And but just like they were fantasy monsters, and I understood that. And I love those kind of monsters, and I still do. And number two is monsters that I always hoped were real. And my flagship monster for that is the Loch Ness Monster. Because as a kid, again, growing up with In Search Of, that was one of the things that would come on in the beginning of that show, was that famous picture of the purported Loch Ness Monster neck and head coming out of the water. Mm-hmm. That freaky reflection. And like, I was so into dinosaurs, and I wanted there to be one that had survived, you know, and that was swimming out to the ocean, like a plesiosaur or something like that. And like, I loved that idea. So I really hoped that that monster was real. So that's, you know, that goes for a lot of those kinds of things, but I chose Loch Ness just to pick a classic. And then the third type is the monster that I always hoped was not real. And that was the one that I am still sure to this day was living right underneath my bed and would grab my hands and my feet if they dangled off the side.
See, this is a classic archaeological question that I ask all the time on this show. What was the ecosystem that those monsters lived in before we invented beds?
That's a great question.
I know. It's like, why is science not answered that one?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at like ethnographic myths and stuff, they're full of like, you know, cautionary tales of this is going to get you and that's going to get you. But I don't know if anyone's ever like wondered where those are, like asked specifically, like they're not hiding in the bed or the closet. So where are they? They're probably like out in the woods. They would often make children go out on these kind of quests to prove their adulthood by going and staying out, you know.
There you go.
Well, I'm just thinking about the life forms that, like, you know, carpenter bees that have now, you know, routinely live in our houses. But, you know, that wasn't until we brought houses to bear. There weren't houses. Where do they live? I mean, I guess they lived in dead wood, but we've certainly made it easier for them. So the bed's just the perfect ecosystem for this particular monster. We really need to do a lot more deep diving on those bed monsters.
We do.
Yeah.
They're out there. I believe it.
Thank you so much for visiting with us, Andy. And we will put links to your article in the show notes, and people can check that out. And thank you for your service in helping to reduce nonsense as we can.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It was a lot of fun. And if I ever say anything else that's interesting to you, let me know.
All right. Well, good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Monster Dog.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just listened to an interview with archaeologist Andy White discussing his 2016 responses to a Bigfoot article about bone stacking in the Pacific Northwest. The original article and some very peculiar ideas researcher Mitchell Townsend has posited have landed him on Coast to Coast AM multiple times. I'll put links to Andy's response and several links to Townsend's work in the show notes for you to check out. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page, as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. You could be listening to almost anything, but you chose to listen to us, and for that, we thank you.
Been a Monster House presentation.